This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's just not going to the Sahel where the biggest problem is, to the most conflict-prone countries, to the most disaster-prone countries. This will, of course, lead to instability in some parts of the world that will come back to haunt the robust world.
That's Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, on the economic impact of COVID-19, pushing refugees and the displaced into hunger and homelessness. Details coming up also. South Africa eases COVID-19 restrictions. And the opposition in Ivory Coast is calling for protests in an effort to stop President Alassane Ouattara from seeking a third term. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. New research by the Norwegian Refugee Council finds the economic impact of COVID-19 is pushing refugees and displaced people in conflict into a hunger, homelessness, and education crisis. The report, Downward Spiral, surveyed 1,400 people in 14 countries in Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, as well as Afghanistan and Central Asia. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
These countries have been plagued with war, violence, climate change, natural and other disasters for years. Now they are faced with the COVID-19 pandemic, which is creating multiple new problems linked to lockdowns and other restrictions aimed at curbing the virus. The Norwegian Refugee Council reports 77% of people surveyed have lost their jobs or income since March. 70% have cut out one or more meals a day and are going hungry. And 73% say they are unlikely to send their children back to school because of economic hardship. NRC Secretary General Jan Egeland warns the world's most vulnerable communities are in a dangerous downward spiral. He says the economic impact of the pandemic is pushing them to catastrophe.
It is now a question of survival for hundreds of millions, and the North, the big economy, is not even close to understanding the crisis in the South, in the countries where we work.
Egeland says the richer countries are contributing less money at a time when developing countries are most in need of their support. As of now, he notes only 25% of the UN's 2020 humanitarian appeals have been funded. He says cries of poverty by industrialized countries are not credible. To press this point, he refers to a UN report which says the Organization for Economic Cooperation and G20 countries have produced stimulus packages amounting to $11 trillion, approximately 10% of global gross domestic product. He says there is money.
It's just not going to the Sahel where the biggest problem is, to the most conflict-prone countries, to the most disaster-prone countries. This will, of course, lead to instability in some parts of the world that will come back to haunt the robust world.
Egeland says it is in the self-interest of the large economies to help the impoverished world weather this pandemic. He warns this crisis will spiral out of control without urgent action. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The South African leg of a COVID-19 vaccine trial led by Oxford University has resumed in earnest. This follows the recent suspension of the study after an adverse reaction by a trial participant in the United Kingdom, which was subsequently found to be unrelated to the substance that's being tested. 2,000 South Africans have been enrolled in the trial, and Darren Taylor reports.
Medical scientists are under pressure to find the vaccine that would end the suffering and death caused by COVID-19. The leader of the trial in South Africa, Professor Shabir Madi, says he's not remotely sure when the medicine could be ready, but he knows when it won't be.
So what I can say with a fair amount of certainty is that we will not get results by the 3rd of November.
U.S. President Donald Trump has suggested that a vaccine could be primed for release before the country's election in 6 weeks.
For you to be able to address the question as to whether the vaccine protects against COVID-19, you need to have X number of individuals that actually develop COVID-19. In South Africa, as an example, we need to get at least about 42 of our participants develop COVID-19 before we would be able to do such an analysis.
Using a complex statistical formula, vaccine researchers set endpoints or outcomes in their trials. These help them calculate how many people need to be enrolled. They can then work out how many infections they need to determine if the vaccine they're testing is effective beyond simply chance. When the study began in Johannesburg in June and cases were peaking in South Africa, Mardi estimated it would reach the magical number of 42 infections by November. But he says things haven't turned out this way.
Fortunately for the country, unfortunately for the vaccine study, now it seems that we probably will only get to those sort of numbers sometime in the first quarter of next year, because there's very little virus circulating. The participants are unlikely to be developing COVID-19 unless there's another resurgence.
He explains that positive results from any one of the three legs of the trial, which includes Brazil, would likely trigger international release of the medicine under what the World Health Organization calls emergency utilization authorization. This permits vaccines to be introduced before they're licensed.
Usually for a vaccine to be licensed by a regulatory authority, they're also wanting a fair amount of safety data. So you can have a situation that you actually start allowing for vaccine usage before it completes all of the hurdles related to regulatory approval. And that wouldn't be unique for COVID-19. A very similar sort of situation existed as an example for Ebola vaccine in West Africa when there was an Ebola outbreak.
Mardi says a second wave of infections could hit South Africa in the near future if what's happened during the Northern Hemisphere summer is anything to go by.
Obviously, that's the period of time when people are going to be a bit more complacent about non-pharmaceutical interventions. So it might well be that we would start seeing less adherence to non-pharmaceutical interventions, that we might see people engaging in family gatherings, etc., during the December vacation period. And then come end of January, beginning of February or so, we might start seeing the resurgence.
The government recently reopened the borders and is hoping for big numbers of foreign visitors to reignite the tourism industry. Some have criticized the move, saying it could cause a significant spike in infections. Mardi disagrees.
We're not the countries such as New Zealand or Australia or Iceland, as an example, which are island nations that have truly been able to contain spread of the virus. We've got virus that is disseminated in terms of its transmission. And having a few visitors come across, what even if they're infected with a virus, it's not going to lead to massive outbreaks. That wouldn't be the reason.
The scientist says South Africa must now focus on maintaining safety measures, such as mask wearing, not on restrictions. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africans woke up to a new normal today as the country further eased COVID-19 restrictions. The move has been welcomed by many who were choking from the limitations on their social and economic life. From Johannesburg to Sokomalo looks at what South Africans will be able to do and not do under what's known as lockdown level one.
Level 1 has brought excitement to the tourism industry and South Africans who like to travel. On October 1, South Africa will open international travel to and from countries with low risk of COVID-19 infections. The move is expected to reboot the tourism industry, which has been battered since the first lockdown was pronounced in March. Scott Langley is the spokesperson at the Durban International Convention Centre.
that Durban and South Africa is open for business. We've got wonderful tourism experiences here. We've got beautiful beaches. We've got fantastic dining experiences. We've got the Drakensberg, which is just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that they really should take advantage of. We've got the Big Five experiences here in South Africa. We've got so much to offer.
Limitations on church, social, political, and conference gatherings has been increased from 50 people to 50% of venues. Casinos, cinemas, and theaters are now permitted to fill up to 50% capacity. However, bigger size will still feel the lockdown bite, as indoor venues are only allowed a maximum of 250 people, while outside venues are capped at 500 people. Those gathered to bury their loved ones can fill up to 50% of the venues, but cannot exceed 100 people. Beer lovers can now drink until midnight at all licensed outlets. Almost all the sectors of the economy are now open, but this unemployed South African, who prefers to remain anonymous, says he has little joy with lockdown level one.
It's not just a fight for jobs because we lost it during the COVID period. We are competing for jobs. So I'm hoping to see more jobs being open and more permanent positions and not temporary positions as I've been working.
And Hosil Hlape, president of the Health Professions Council of South Africa, cautions that level one does not signal the end of COVID-19.
This is the calm before the storm, so we should expect the second wave later in the year or the beginning of next year. So we should not let our guard off. We should be vigilant. We should be grateful that the economy is opening up so that livelihoods can be restored. But we should not relent in terms of the non-pharmaceutical interventions.
And not all restrictions have been lifted. There is a curfew between 12 midnight and 4 a.m. Wearing of masks, sanitizing of hands, and social distancing remain mandatory in all public spaces. Nightclubs remain closed. Spectators are still not permitted at sporting events, and international sports events are still banned. Tuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Libyan National Army Commander Khalifa Haftar said Friday his forces would lift their 8-month-old blockade of oil exports. But 2 days later, the head of the High Council of State, Khalid al-Mishri, rejected the deal by President Council member Ahmed Meitig and Haftar's son Khalid, saying it violates Libyan political agreement laws. Ali Mishri called for an urgent investigation with Meitig. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis, about the latest development in Libya.
If most people simplify Libya's politics into East and West, they assume that the different political entities in the West support each other against those of the East. Now that is manifestly not true, because the Western Deputy Prime Minister, Ahmed Meitig, has gone behind the back of his Prime Minister, Fayez Sarraj, and made a deal with Haftar and the East. And this then reconfigures the divisions such that we don't have East and West anymore. We have those factions who are willing to work with Haftar and those who are not. That's the new division. And Khalid al-Mishri, the head of the Higher Council of State, is completely right to reject the quote-unquote deal by saying they negotiated a deal that they have no power to enforce, either de facto, militarily or structurally, or legally or practically. The two people who negotiated this deal are not even those who have the right to say when the oil sector should open or not. And that just shows you that everything about this deal was done about the optics of reconfiguring Libya's political map.
Haftar and allied forces, including mercenaries from Russia's Wagner Group, hold some of Libya's largest oil fields and export ports, and the Libyan National Oil Company had already rejected any return to operations until they left the facilities, citing the safety of its staff. Is that feasible?
Well, that's what's playing out in the sense that the oil sector in Libya is partially back online. Sanallah, the head of the NOC, has chosen what fields he would like to have open, and he's chosen those where the Wagner presence at the terminals is minimal. So this means Zweitina, Brega, Hariga, they're open. Whereas Ras Lanuf, Sidra, where it's clear that either the LNA is using the military airstrips in those locations or there are Wagner forces stationed at the oil facilities, they're remaining off. Surprisingly, Sharara in the south and west, which feeds Zawiya, has been partially reopened, even though there may be some militarization there. And that's kind of a gut call of Sanallah. Is this feasible to have the sector partially off and partially on? It's been done in the past because Libyan militiamen have taken fields and ports to try to blackmail the government. So we're used to a situation in which fields come on and then off and there are partial reopenings. So this is a step in the right direction. Hopefully the media optics allow the good guys to take it forward and get the mercenaries out.
Haftar said the command of his forces had put aside all military and political considerations to respond to the deterioration of living conditions in Libya. The announcement comes after hundreds of Libyans protested last week in the eastern city of Benghazi, one of Haftar's strongholds, and other cities over the corruption, power cuts, and shortages in petroleum and cash. What do you make of Haftar's move?
Well, it's a very shrewd political move, but it's not unself-interested and selfless, as he points out. It is completely political conditions which has allowed Haftar to make this move. After he lost the battle for Tripoli and diplomacy has started using Aqila Saleh instead of him to represent the East, he's been sidelined. So the one thing he has is the fact that he took the oil sector offline and can claim to turn it back on. So he's inserted himself into the media and political negotiations this way. And it's been a master stroke. Haftar is now back at the top table. And even more brilliantly, he has gotten people to show that he wants to turn the oil sector back on, but it's others who, for their reasons, are delaying that. That's, of course, false. Haftar took the sector off. He can turn it on when he wants to, but he has shrewdly manipulated the media. That's why I think that this story isn't going to be over. The battle over the oil sector is the battle over who has legitimacy to control Libya right now.
That was Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi. The opposition in Ivory Coast is calling for protests in an effort to stop President Alassane Ouattara from seeking a third term. Reuters reports that former Prime Minister Guillaume Soro is advocating for legal means to halt Ouattara's candidacy. Henry Konan Bedi, the main challenger to the incumbent president, has also gotten in on the act, claiming it is unconstitutional to seek a third term. He says only civil disobedience can stop a Ouattara. Ouattara, on the other hand, says a change in the constitution has reset his two-term limit. He announced his intentions to run last month following the sudden death of the handpicked successor. At least a dozen people have been killed in anti-Ouattara protests since his announcement, raising memories of a disputed election in 2010 that led to a brief civil war and the deaths of around 3,000 people. Organizations such as the World Bank, IMF, and the Jack Ma Foundation have contributed more than $2 billion in aid for Kenya's fight against COVID-19. But much of the money and donated medical supplies have gone missing, prompting President Uhuru Kenyatta to order an investigation into who might have taken it. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
These are some of the PPE kits.
Dr. Godwin Agutu is CEO of the Network Action Against Corruption, an organization sanctioned by the Kenyan government to promote fiscal accountability. The NAC accuses KEMSA, a government agency that supplies medicine and medical equipment to the Ministry of Health, of embezzling hundreds of millions of dollars meant for the COVID-19 battle. The network says officials in KEMSA ran multiple schemes. and one, NAC says, the organization paid for personal protective equipment, or PPEs, that was actually donated by the Jack Ma Foundation. The money then went to phony companies controlled by the KEMSA officials. In another, NAC says KEMSA officials contracted with fictitious shell companies to supply protective equipment. No equipment was supplied, but the companies got paid anyway. Speaking to VOA, Dr. Agutu said the officials also planned to resell PPEs on the black market.
The PPE kits consist of a number of items. But you realize even these particular people, what they used to do, the PPE kits which they stole from Jack Ma's donation, they would break it down. So they have the coveralls separately, they have the boots separately, they have the supplied separately. So you can imagine how much were they intending to make out of that.
Kenya's President Kenyatta has ordered a forensic audit into the use of both state and donor funds meant to be used to combat COVID-19.
That all persons found to be prima facie culpable as a result of those ongoing investigations should be brought to book.
Caroline Geiter is the executive director at Mzalendo Trust, a parliamentary monitoring organization. Geiter says mismanagement of the money and protective gear is affecting Kenya's response to the coronavirus pandemic.
We've seen, even as we speak now, the level of preparedness for COVID is still not there yet. The isolation units that were meant to be put up are not ready. We've seen doctors complaining about lack of PPEs. So it would seem that we got these resources, but we have not used them for the right reason, and yet we will continuously pay for them.
Dr. Samuel Oroko is the national chairman at the Kenya Medical Practitioners and Dentists Union. Oroko says the shortage of protective supplies coupled with the low quality of those made available is having far-reaching effects.
The doctors and the workers working in the outpatient department should be given N95 each and every day they see patients. Due to lack of enough and quality PPEs has led to more than almost 1,000 healthcare workers being infected with the coronavirus.
Kenya's Senate and investigative agencies have been tasked with unraveling the allegations of misappropriated funds. Meanwhile, the country's health ministry has recorded more than 36,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
Wildlife officials in Botswana say the recent deaths of hundreds of elephants in the Okavango Delta Panhandle was caused by waterborne bacteria. Mokandisi Dube reports from Habrone.
More than 330 elephants died in the panhandle between April and June, and wildlife officials did not know the cause. The carcasses were found with their tusks intact, eliminating the possibility of poachers. Dr. Madi Ruben, the chief veterinary officer for Botswana's Department of Wildlife and National Parks, told the news conference Monday that the cause was cyanobacteria, a waterborne bacteria that produces deadly toxins which can affect an elephant's nervous system. He said officials are still investigating why the bacteria affected only elephants.
So we know the elephant to really be the only animal, for example, that is drinking below the surface of the water. And where the depth is a challenge, it clearly shows the possibility of this species being able to suck the silt, which is really where the growth of this cyanobacteria is.
Department of Wildlife and National Parks Deputy Director Cyril Daulo said cyanobacteria develops when environmental changes occur. The vast Okavango Delta experienced a dry period until recently when water levels began rising.
This is not a phenomenon that was just seen now. It is something that happens quite a lot when there are these environmental changes. So at this point in time, we certainly cannot talk about any human involvement.
Poachers have decimated elephant populations in other parts of Africa, but in Botswana, the animals continue to thrive. The country is the world's largest elephant herd, estimated at more than 130,000. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.